Good afternoon, and thank you for listening to KWMR. This is KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. KWMR is supported by Willow Creek Wealth Management, serving the North Bay since 1984, offering independent, fee-only wealth consultation. Information available at willowcreekwealth.com. Please stay tuned to KWMR for Tea Time Books coming right up. Well, that wonderful J.S. Bach cello suite music played there by Alexander Rudin heralds another edition of Tea Time Books this afternoon with Howard Dillon reading to you from Between the Woods and the Water by Patrick Lee Fermor. And for those of you who've been listening to the program, this is the second in a trilogy of books by Patrick Lee Fermor, in which he, as a young man, set out from England and began to walk across Western Europe and took a ship from London to Holland and then proceeded to start walking eastwards across Europe. And right now he's got into Hungary and he's talking about what he's encountering in Hungary. And he's sort of dividing his time. He spends part of the time just sleeping rough in barns and shepherd's huts and sometimes a river barge or whatever he can find. And the rest of the time he has connections with aristocratic people who live in wonderful old castles or palaces and big private libraries. And so he goes between what you might call the high life and living rough. And, of course, much of the high life style of those days vanished during and after the Second World War. So it's kind of a lost world that he's describing here. So here we go with more from Patrick Lee Fermor, Between the Woods and the Water. The Magyars first settled in Central Europe at the end of the 9th century as fierce pagan invaders. 400 years later, when they had been respectable for at least 3, their country had become a great Christian kingdom, and the Arpads, who ruled over it, by now an ancient dynasty of warrior kings, legislators, crusaders, and saints, were allied to most of the great houses of Christendom. King Bela IV, brother of St. Elizabeth, was the ablest of them. He lived in turbulent times. In recent decades, Genghis Khan and his descendants had laid Asia waste from the China Sea to the Ukraine. And in the spring of 1241, news of great danger reached Hungary. After burning Kiev, Genghis Khan's grandson, Batu, was heading for the eastern passes. Bela tried to prepare defenses, but the Mongols' onslaught through the Carpathians was so fast that they surprised and routed the sleepy Magyar nobles and then ranged over the great plain, emptying and burning the towns all through the summer. promising the peasants their lives if they brought in the harvest. They slaughtered them in the autumn when it was safely threshed. Then, crossing the frozen river on Christmas Day, they set about the western regions. A few towns were saved by their walls or by the surrounding fens, but Estergom was burnt and most of the others were soon in cinders, and the inhabitants slain or driven off as slaves. Suddenly, there was a lull. Messengers had arrived in the Mongol camp with the news that 5,000 miles away in Karakorum, Ogodai, the successor of Genghis Khan, had died, and all at once on the marches of Siberia and beyond the Great Wall, in the ruined kingdoms of the Caliphate, among the wreckage of Krakow and Sandomir, and the Moravian pine forests, and the smoking Magyar cities, a scattering of savage princes turned their boyish faces towards Chinese Tartary. The race for the succession was about to start, and by the middle of March they had all vanished. Bela, returning from an island refuge in Dalmatia, found his kingdom in ruins. Death and capture had halved the population, and the survivors were cautiously beginning to emerge from the woods. His task resembled the founding of a new kingdom, and the first step was to make it secure against the Mongols, hence the castle that I was striding through at Visegrad. Up went this tremendous stronghold, and many others followed, and the next time the Mongols invaded, they were repulsed. As much German as Magyar was to be heard on the half-awake quay of Visegrad, for the speakers were Geza's Swabians. When the Turks were driven out, thousands of peasant families from South Germany had boarded flat-bottomed boats and set off from the cities of the Upper Danube, chiefly from Ulm. Sailing downstream, they landed on the depopulated shore and settled for good. Their language and their costumes on feast days were said to have remained unaltered since the time of Maria Theresa, in whose reign they had taken root. There must have been a lot of intermarriage, but spotting people with obligingly tow-coloured or raven hair, I thought, and probably wrongly, I could pick out a typically German from a typically Magyar. When the path along the Danube turned east, the radiance of morning poured along the valley. Soon the cape of a slender island, plumed with willow trees and patterned with fields of young wheat, divided the river in two. Nets were looped from branch to branch. Fishing boats were moored to the trunks of aspens, poplars and willows, and pewter-coloured stems lifted a silvery pale-green haze against the darker leaves of the riverside woods. The island followed the river's windings for nearly 20 miles. A trim steamer ruffled the current now and then, and as the day advanced, the sparse traffic of barges multiplied. But within an hour or two, the river began to conduct itself in a fashion unprecedented since our first snowy meeting at Ulm 11 weeks earlier. Only 11 weeks! It seemed half a lifetime already. Indeed, ever since the river had first bubbled out of the underworld in Prince Fürstenberg's park in the Black Forest. For the Danube, after describing two congruent semicircles, was turning due south, and so it would continue, flowing clean across Hungary for 180 miles, from the top to the bottom of the Atlas page, as it were, until it turned again and streamed eastwards under the battlements of Belgrade. It was an exciting moment. By late afternoon, towards the end of the island which had kept me company all day, I reached Szentendre, a little baroque country town of lanes, cobbled streets, tiled roofs, and belfries with onion cupolas. The hills were lower now, Vineyards and orchards had replaced the cliffs and the forests, and there was a feeling in the air that one was nearing a great city. The townspeople were the descendants of Serbians who'd fled from the Turks 3 centuries ago. They still talked Serbian and worshipped in the Greek Orthodox cathedral which their ancestors had built. Griechisch Orientalisch in German. They're distinct from the Uniars further east. Griechisch Katholik, who, although they cling to the Orthodox rite, acknowledge the Pope. And he learnt about this later, but an icon instead of a crucifix on my bedroom wall ought to have put me on the scent. Chapter 2, Budapest. When a mid-morning sunbeam prized one eyelid open a few days later, I couldn't think where I was. An aroma of coffee and croissants was afloat under a vaulted ceiling. Furniture gleamed with beeswax and elbow grease. Books ascended in hundreds. And across the arms of a chair embroidered with a blue rampant lion with a forked tail and a scarlet tongue, a dinner jacket was untidily thrown. An evening tie hung from the looking-glass. Pumps lay in different corners. The crumpled torso of a stiff shirt, still worn with the black tie in those days, gesticulated desperately across the carpet. Borrowed links glittered in the cuffs. The sight of all this alien plumage, so unlike the travel-stained heap that normally met my waking eyes, was a sequence of conundrums. Then suddenly illumination came. I was in Budapest. Little remains of the journey from Szentendre, a confused impression of cobbled approaches, the beginning of tram lines, some steep streets and airy views of the Danube and its bridges, and the search for the hills of Buda. The subsequent magnificence was due at one or two removes to the Baltic Russian friends in Munich, whose kindness had begun in recent weeks to scatter my rough itinerary with oases like this. I was back among barons, and these ones lived on the steep hill of Buda, the Var or citadel, which lifted the empty royal palace high above the right bank of the river. The Uri Utka, the Herrengasse in German, a waving street of jutting windows, tiled roofs, and arched doors with coats of arms, ran along the very summit of this castled height. It must have been built soon after 1686, when the city was recaptured from the Turks, and the foundations of many of the houses were tunnelled with sinister Turkish cellars. Perched above the din of the capital, this patrician quarter had something of the hush of a country town, and the houses inhabited by the same families for generations were called Palais so-and-so, including the charming one that harboured me. "All rot, of course," my hostess said. She'd been brought up largely in England. "We seem to have a passion for grand styles in Hungary. It's a perfectly ordinary townhouse." Tibor and Berta were in their mid-40s. Duly forewarned, they'd taken me under their wing with a completeness for which Estegom might have been some preparation. The way Hungarians construed hospitality seemed a recurring miracle. Tibor was a captain in a regiment of horse gunners, and the lowness of his rank, for he'd served all through the war, was due to the minute size of the Hungarian army after the Treaty of Trianon. Liked by everyone, amusing, rather caustic, intolerant of nonsense, and usually dressed in a tweed coat and skirt, Berta was tall and handsome with a stripe of grey in her dark hair. Her father, a distinguished graf, or rather grof in Hungary, Hungarian, had been a governor of Fiume before the war. And as we drove about Budapest in her small car, she told me fascinating stories about the lost world of Trieste, Fiume, Pola, and the Istrian Peninsula. The family, like many another, was fairly hard up now, and some of the house was let. She sat on many committees and was always busy.
I was caught up in her activities, accompanying her on shopping expeditions combined with sightseeing. If she thought they promised interest or amusement, I went with her on calls. And when in a couple of days there was a dance in a house nearby, she got me asked and set about assembling even things from Thibault's wardrobe and then from neighbours. When I asked if she were going, she laughed and said, "Catch me, but you'll enjoy it." And so I did. The ball was all that it should have been, and as she pointed out, it took place in a real palace. On the stairs leading to the ballroom, a friendly touch on the elbow revealed my stork-loving Estergom ally, who promptly resumed his role of mentor. The ball ended with the band breaking into gypsy tunes and launching a number of the dancers into the sardas. One young couple, he with his hands on his partner's hips and hers on his shoulders, threw themselves into it with a marvellously fierce and stamping brio, their hair flinging about like the manes of ponies. When all seemed over, I crammed with them the stork fancier, his beautiful partner, a girl I clove to called Anna Maria, and several others, into a couple of cars and whirled downhill and across the chain bridge to plunge into the scintillating cave of the most glamorous nightclub I have ever seen. Did the floor of the Arizona really revolve? Certainly seemed to. Snowy steeds were careering around it at one moment, feathers tossing. Someone said he'd seen camels there, even elephants. A bit later, spangled acrobats were flying through the spotlit cigarette smoke, joining, somersaulting, spiraling on their own axes, sailing with arms outstretched as timely rings flew to their palms from the temporary surrounding dark. And finally, poised on the biceps of a sequin-studded titan, they built a human pagoda, skipping nimbly aloft over each other's shoulders until, from the apex, somewhere near the ceiling, a slim, frilled figure with a star on her brow was blowing kisses. There was something familiar about this blonde and smiling team. Suddenly I recognized them. They were my old friends from those sketching forays in Vienna, Conrad's and my indirect benefactors for a dozen Himbeergeist. A friend actually posted their posters, Koldozdatos Korshak, kept hitting me in the eye for the rest of my stay. After this, we drank some more in a house in the Verboshki Utka, and when Anna Maria showed me the way back to the nearby Uri Utka, we were not sure whether it was the noon, the moon, or dawn that cast our shadows on the cobbles. So it was no wonder that the reflected 11 o'clock sunlight, when it hit the side of the silver coffee pot, detonated like silent shell fire. The door flung open, and a black Alsatian dog called Tim bounded in and leapt on the bed. He was followed by his owner, Mickey Miklosh, the son of the house, rather unruly and very entertaining boy of 14 in tam-tam plus fours. "Here," he said, giving me a tumbler of water with one hand and a bottle of Alka-Seltzer with the other. "My ma says you probably need these." I had drifted into a noctambulist set, and my stay in Budapest was punctuated by awakenings like this. Life seemed perfect, kind, uncensorious hosts, dashing, resplendent, and beautiful new friends against the background of a captivating town, a stimulating new language, strong and startling drinks, food like a delicious bonfire, and a prevailing atmosphere of sophistication and high spirits. That would have been impossible to resist, even had I wanted to. I was excited by the famous delights of the place, especially by certain haunts like Kakuk, the cuckoo on the slopes of Buda, where late at night half a dozen gypsies bore down on the guests like smiling crows bent on steeping everything in their peculiar music. Badly played, this can sound like treacle and broken bottles, and the tunes may not be authentically Hungarian. Bartok and Kodaly are firm about their gypsy and thus non-Magyar origin, but they deceived Liszt, and they enraptured me. In the slow passages, the hammers of the cembalom fluttered and hesitated over the strings, and the violin sank to a swooning languor, only to rekindle with an abrupt syncope when the hammers and the bows broke into double time, and the cymbalist went mad as the leading violinist, with his fingers crowding the strings in a dark tangle, stooped and slashed beside one listener's ear after another, and closed in on his instrument like a welterweight in a clinch. Passages one might think which could only end in ecstasy or a dead faint. Soaring glissandos, cascading pingos, all eyes grew mistier as cork after cork was drawn. Who paid for all this? Certainly not me. Even a gesture towards helping was jovially brushed aside as though it were not worth the waste of words. The day after I arrived, I had made for the consulate in the Zoltan Utka and picked up a registered envelope with an unprecedented £6, which had mounted up since Vienna. Very many of these people talked English. When an exception cropped up, German was used, sometimes, I think, for historical reasons, rather reluctantly. But it was the universal second language. The automatic use of du, even to strangers, if they were friends of friends, was very surprising. Si, it seemed, meant relegation to the outer darkness, and people had been known to fight with swords about the matter. The fact that duels were still frequent in Hungary, not mere student encounters, but fierce set-tos with sabres, gave a prisoner of Zenda touch to a fantastic and no doubt wildly inaccurate picture which was fast taking shape in my mind. Their easy ways, like the Austrians, had a stiffening of old-fashioned punctilio. I liked the kissing of women's hands, but the formal kissing of the hands of men by household staff or by peasants seemed strange. It was the custom all over Eastern Europe, and after a while it seemed not servile so much as antiquated, a hoary ritual surviving like fealty from feudal times, which, of course, is exactly what it was. These particular Hungarians cared a lot about dress. Tigers for turnout, they were well-groomed in what used to be thought the English style, for they didn't give a damn about my rough-and-ready outfit. The best I could manage was a tweed coat and some grey canvas trousers, which, with a clean shirt and a blue tie, looked almost presentable. But the footgear let me down. This was always gym or tennis shoes, whichever looked cleaner. But it didn't matter. After a lifetime of educational croppers and bad school reports, my luck seemed suddenly to have changed. Ever since my halt in Munich, letters with exhortations to kindness from my Baltic Russian friends there, and then from the friends they had written to, had been flying eastwards, and they unloosed cornucopias of warm and boundless hospitality when I caught up with them. I was full of gratitude to my benefactors, and I loved them, but I don't think I ever actually wondered why I struck so lucky. If their friends had asked them to help, I suppose they couldn't quite wash their hands of me, but the main reason for their hospitality was a general kind feeling towards the young and the broke. The accident of nationality may also have been a help, particularly then. I think Hungarians had a definite soft spot for England. Absorption and enjoyment are catching, and my attitude to life resembled a sea lion's to the flung bloater. They were amused by accounts of the journey. Some said they wished they'd done the same, and they were impressed that I only took lifts in really bad weather. Nobody else was travelling like this in those days, so the expedition had the value of rarity. It's almost past belief, but only once during the whole journey did I meet another soul who'd set out in the same way. A couple of months earlier, on the road between Ulm and Augsburg, I dived out of a snowstorm into a lonely guesthouse, and the only other customer taking refuge there was a strange-looking boy about my age, dressed in a black corduroy jacket and a scarlet waistcoat with brass buttons, who was banging the snow off an already very battered top hat with his forearm. Back askew on his head, it gave him the look of Sam Weller. He told me, as we threw schnapps down our throats, that he was wearing the traditional costume of a Hamburg chimney sweep's apprentice, emblematic of a secret sweeps guild which stretched all over Europe. It ensured a welcome from his colleagues everywhere. His circular brushes and his slotted bamboo staves were strapped to the bottom of his rucksack just in case. While he explained that he was heading south to Innsbruck and the Brenner and then down into Italy, he unfolded his map on the table and his finger traced Bolzano, Trento, the Adige, Lake Garda, Verona, Mantua, Modena, Bologna, and the Apennine passes leading to Florence. And as he uttered the glorious names, he waved his hand in the air as though Italy lay all about us. "Kommst du nicht mit?" Why not? It was tempting, and he was an amusing chap. Then I thought of all the registered envelopes I was hoped were waiting in Munich and all the mysteries of Eastern Europe that I would miss. "Schade," he said. "What a shame." Warmed by another schnapps or two, we helped each other on with our burdens, and he set off for the Tyrol and Rome and the land where the lemon trees bloomed, and waved his top hat as he grew fainter through the snowfall. We both shouted Godspeed against the noise of the wind, and wondering whether I'd done the right thing, I plodded on, eyelashes clogged with flakes, towards Bavaria and Constantinople. The house in the Uri Utka was full of helpful books. Above all, there were the Encyclopaedia Britannica and Meyer's Conversations Lexicon, both of them firm standbys throughout the journey, and I found a wide window seat to pile them on. There was a book on learning Hungarian, and I made a fumbling assault on it, though my vocabulary never got beyond 100 words or so, most of them nouns. Coming from a great distance and wholly unrelated to the Teutonic, Latin, and Slav languages that fence it in, Hungarian has remained miraculously intact. Everything about the language is different, not only the words themselves, but the way they're formed, the syntax and grammar, and above all the cast of mind that brought them into being. I knew that Magyar belonged to the Ugro-Finnic group, part of the great Ural-Altaic family. Just as one of my new friends told me, just as English belongs to the Indo-European. He followed this up by saying the language closest to Hungarian was Finnish. How close? Oh, very. Well, like Italian and Spanish? Well, no, not quite as close as that. How close, then? After a thoughtful pause, he said, about like English and Persian. But it seems that one can get one step nearer with the languages of the Ostiaks and the Vogels. Reckoned only in thousands, these small groups of kindly skin-clad folk dwell in the fens and the tundras between the upper Urals, and the Ob River in western Siberia. They inhabit half-underground huts and birch-bark shelters, and up to their waists in snow hunt the woods for bears, which simultaneously gods and quarry they also worship. And when the ice melts, they fish and set traps and graze their reindeer across the moss at pains to segregate them from the enormous neighbouring herds of their distant cousins, the Samoyeds. It was no help at first to learn that Magyar, whose resonance is fast, incisive, and distinct, is an agglutinative language. The word merely conjures up the sound of mumbling through a mouthful of toffee. It means the words are never inflected as they are in Europe, and that changes of sense are conveyed by a concatenation of syllables stuck on behind the first. All the vowel sounds imitate their leader, and the invariable ictus on the leading syllable sets up a kind of dactylic or anapaestic canter, which to a new ear gives Magyar a wild and most unfamiliar ring. So when, at the dance, I was listening to vernacular sentences of my monocled and stork-loving Estergom friend while he poured whiskey out of a cut-glass decanter and then to his marvellous-looking partner, as with a deft tongue she took a deft languor, she took a cigarette out of a gold and shagreen case that snapped shut with an emerald and answered him through the smoke. It was impossible not to wonder among what unconjecturable scenery of marshland and desert and woods, when the Magyar tongue was beginning to shake itself loose from the primitive Ugrian magma, these sounds could first have been uttered. On a printed page, the fierce-looking sentences let slip no hint of their drift. You're listening to KWMR. This is Tea Time Books. KWMR is at 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. You're listening to Howard Dillon reading to you from Between the Woods and the Water by Patrick Lee Fermor, the story of a young man from England walking across Europe in 1934, and he's in Budapest in Hungary talking about the Magyar language. And we'll get back to him in just a moment. So back to Patrick Lee Fermor and Between the Woods and the Water, the story of a young man, Englishman, walking across Europe in 1934. Ah, yes, the Magyar, the Hungarian language. On a printed page, the fierce-looking sentences let slip no hint of their drift. Those tangles of S's and Z's, gazing at the peppery string of diaresses and the tempests of acute accents all swaying one way like wind-blown corn, I wondered if I would ever be able to extort a meaning. My first effort was discouraging. There was a snug kaffeehuis, a coffee house. If only all Magyar were as easy as this. Less than a minute's walk away in Holy Trinity Square, I could just manage St. Haraminster, St. Tricia Place, and I was spending a morning of showery weather there with books and writing things. The coffee-house windows surveyed ancient palaces and the tall, restored Gothic steeple of the Coronation Church, and just in front, a plinth sprang from the cobbles and lifted a bronze horseman called Andreas Haddick into the raindrops. He was a commander in the Seven Years' War who had dodged the armies of Frederick the Great, swooped on Berlin with a cavalcade of hussars, looted the place at lightning speed, and galloped away again. At the next table, the only other person in the coffee house was a frail, white-haired man reading the Pesti Hirlep. I couldn't take my eyes off the headline. It ran, "O Bulldog Anglo-Lorschlag." I knew that the last word meant England, and the rest was obvious. It could only mean, "O Bulldog England," "O English Bulldog," or something of the kind. The photograph below showed the Prince of Wales in a golfing pullover with a bold lozenge pattern and a tweed cap. But, very puzzlingly, the dog under his arm, which simultaneously stole the picture and turned it into an enigma, was a fox terrier. They must have muddled the breeds. I couldn't resist asking the reader in German if I'd understood the words correctly. He laughed and answered in English, "No, it was nothing to do with dogs. Bulldog is happy or fortunate England," was what the caption meant, and the gist of the article was England's good luck in having so promising a crown prince. Hungary was a kingdom too, my neighbour ruefully added, but they only had a regent. The apostolic crown was empty. The apostolic crown. I had heard much about it. reproduced on buildings, coins, flags, cap badges and buttons, and on the top of all public notices, it was seldom out of sight, until it should be needed for some future coronation. But whose and when? The crown itself was guarded in the royal palace. Over the centuries, the shrewd marriage policy of the Habsburgs had absorbed most of the neighbouring kingdoms, and finally Hungary, and the last sovereign had been King Karl and Queen Zita, who were also, of course, Austria's last emperor and empress. After the loss of both these thrones at the end of the Great War and the breakdown of their brief and illicit return to Hungary, the lingering hopes of the dynasty had faded, and now the exiled king was dead. In photographs, his son, Archduke Otto, the present claimant, was usually dressed as a Hungarian magnate, but these pictures were seen more often in his native Austria than here. Nevertheless, the state was, constitutionally, a kingdom, still under the regency of Admiral Horthy. The beautiful Empress Elizabeth, their last queen but one, who had been assassinated in Switzerland in 1898 by an anarchist, was still their favourite. Framed on desks and tables and grand pianos, there she was, in 19th-century coronation robes, reading under a tree, clearing terrific fences in Northamptonshire or Meath, or pensively at gaze, stroking her enormous wolfhound, Shadow. She had loved Hungary and the Hungarians, learnt Magyar, and rushed to Hungary's defence in all discussions. Above all, she flung herself with fearlessness and skill into all their equestrian pursuits. Her love was returned with interest and still declared 36 years after her assassination with all the ardour of Burke for Marie Antoinette. Now, only the crown was left. It was Hungary's most sacred object. Vicissitudes beset it, and unconjecturable journeys and adventures lay ahead. Wrought in battered gold, with its culminating cross askew, it was the actual diadem Pope Sylvester II sent to St. Stephen when he was crowned first king of Hungary in A.D. 1000. But the later addition of enamel plaques, gold chains, and pendant gems gave it an unquestionably Byzantine look, fitter for a mosaic sovereign by the Bosphorus, or at Ravenna, one would think, than for a canopied monarch of the West. No wonder the gold and enameled circlet was the gift of a Byzantine emperor to a later sovereign, who promptly clasped it round the Pope's original gift to his ancestor, and the gleaming hybrid is an apt symbol of the early Hungarian kingdom. For blandishments from the East, as well as the West, had flickered over the great Hungarian plain with the ambivalence of a mirage. Except for those dank cellars on the Var, wandering about the steep and exhilarating city, unearthed scarce marks of the long sojourn of the Turks. A few Ottoman fragments, the tomb of a dervish on the Hill of Roses, some hammam cupolas scattered about, later a mosque here and there in the provinces. There had been 2.5 centuries for the town to recover, in long enough, perhaps, to surround the Turkish interlude with romance, and to remind the Magyars that, genealogically speaking, if one goes far enough back into Asian prehistory, the races are distant cousins. But it was hard, during my exploration, to imagine the skyline, the clustering domes, the minarets, and the fluttering crescents, which Charles of Lorraine and his reconquering companions must have gazed at when they laid siege to Buda in 1686. Foreign soldiers flocked to the Hungarian wars, and among them more than one Stuart on the wrong side of the blanket, starting with the 16-year-old Duke of Berwick. Berwick, James II's son with Marlborough's sister Arabella. He astonished the besieging army by his wild valour in the assault on Bude, and 2 years after it fell, his first cousin, St. Albans, Charles II's 18-year-old son with Nell Gwynne, fought bravely at the storming of Belgrade. Little is known about them in England, but these faraway campaigns invariably assembled stirring and eccentric figures from the British Isles in every kind of adventurer. Wild geese, clan chieftains, recusant Catholics, Jacobite exiles, and soldiers of fortune trailing the puissant pike rushed to the double eagle banner. For these wars held all the glamour of the Crusades. Sir Philip Sidney, travelling about Hungary as an ambassador on leave, was in a different category, but otherwise the earliest English arrival I could find was Sir Richard Grenville, fighting on land against Solomon the Magnificent 25 years before the Revenge. The next was Thomas Arundel, a great favourite of Elizabeth's in spite of his religion. He won great glory in the imperial service, and at the storming of Estagon in 1595, he forced the water tower and captured the enemy's banner with his own hand, a deed which prompted Rudolf II to make him a count of the Holy Roman Empire. When he got home, his joyful flaunting of the title irritated the English nobility. It put his father, Sir Matthew, a mere knight, beside himself, and it infuriated the Queen. "My dogs shall wear no collar but my own." She sent him to the Fleet Prison for a spell. Perhaps it was to stop all this foreign nonsense that James I made him Lord Arundel of Wardour. The Holy Roman honour surfaced again generations later when his remarkable and equally courageous descendant, Isabel Arundel, wife of Sir Richard Burton, the explorer, cut a dash in Trieste by using her rank as born Grafin, quite in conformity with Austrian custom, when Burton was consul there. She was running a sort of local RSPCA, Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and as the town was Austrian still, it was probably a shrewd move. Her other pursuits were swimming, riding, and fencing with her husband. It's a pity she burnt his papers. Later, in Rilke's Wies von Liebe und Tod de Johann Christoph Rilke, I came on an evocation of these old Turkish campaigns which suddenly brought all the chronicles to life. The poem commemorates a vague, perhaps imaginary, kinsman of the poet, a young cornet and standard-bearer in a regiment of horse in 1663, billeted for a night in a Hungarian frontier castle beyond the Raab. He's woken by frenzied neighing and trumpets sounding boot and saddle. There's a roar of burning. The enemy has surrounded and set light to the castle. Tearing himself from the arms of the young chatelaine, he's only just in time to seize the smouldering colour and rush down the stone steps. The flag bursts into a great flame as he charged into the turbaned ranks, and he's lost to sight at last under a 16-fold flash of scimitars. I explored the Var, the fortress of Buda, that is, with Mickey and Tim, the huge black Alsatian dog, and began to get the hang of this lofty quarter and the old houses there, the lanes, the churches, and the steep streets. They sank like trenches between silent walls where branches and creepers showered over the coping. On a bus trip, a mile or two north to Roman Aquincum, we were joined by a beautiful girl of about 14 called Harry, part Croatian, part Polish as well as Hungarian. Tim, the dog, bounded about among the sarcophagi and broken walls and the ruined amphitheatre and dug for bones in the temple of the unconquered sun. And in the museum we gazed at one of those disturbing bas-reliefs of Mithras in a Phrygian cap, plunging a dagger into the bull's throat. The god always wears an expression of unbearable anguish, as though the throat were his own, a hound leaps up to drink the blood, and down below a furtive scorpion wages war. A favourite of the legions, he was worshipped all along the frontier, and there was hardly a camp between Carlisle and the Black Sea without one of his shrines. This last gasp of the Alpine range was also the last bastion of Roman Pannonia, for the empire stopped at the river's bank. The Iberian cavalry stationed here must have peered across with misgiving. Beyond the vague settlements of Celts or Quadi or Sarmatians, the grim plain ran away to infinity. Gepids, Vandals, and finally the Huns replaced them in turn, until Rome itself collapsed and the Dark Ages set in. The Avars came next, Deserta Avarorum. Their name hung bleakly over the waste for dim, unchronicled centuries, until Charlemagne scattered them, and without knowing it, cleared a space for the westernmost settlement of the Bulgars. The new state bombinated briefly in the vacuum until, at last, the hour struck for the Magyars. After centuries of shadowy Asian wandering, they streamed out of the wings and settled on center stage forever. Except for the old quarter along the opposite bank, modern Pesht only really came into existence in the last century. It spread insatiably across the plain, and I could see great Oxford Street like the Andrassy Oot and the Rakoshi Oot slicing their canyons through the boom city. The quiet citadel my side of the water had long ago been outstripped. Precariously linked by boat or briefly each year by the ice, Buda and Pesht, the names as well as the places, were joined to each other only in the 1840s. One was often told that the tremendous Szczecin chain bridge was built by two Scotsmen, the brothers Clark. Apart from a few old streets and squares, the smart Duna Palota Hotel and the cheerful and pleasure-loving waterfront, especially the Patisserie Gerbo, a dashing Gunters-like meeting place by the statue of the poet Voroshmati, I liked Pesht much less than my own side of the town, but I never tired of surveying it from the Fisher Bastion. This vantage point by the Coronation Church commanded steep descending layers, plumed all the way down with trees, then a sweep of the Danube crossed by half a dozen bridges. St. Margaret's Island expanded upstream, and the Houses of Parliament loomed from the opposite shore. Built at the turn of the century, and aswarm with statues, this frantic and marvellous pile was a tall, steep-roofed Gothic nave escorted for a prodigious length by medieval pinnacles touched with gilding and adorned with crockets, and it was crowned at the point where its transepts intersected by the kind of ribbed and egg-shaped dome that might more predictably have dominated the roofs of a Renaissance town in Tuscany, except that the dome itself was topped by a sharp and bristling Gothic spire. Architectural dash could scarcely go further. Flights of steps, arched and roofed in like slanting cloisters, zigzag downhill from this area, and I always seemed to be out of breath from toiling up them or rushing down full tilt and herring across the Szczecin Bridge, late for some appointment in Pesht, in one particular case for luncheon at 7 Josef Ter, just the other side. My hostess at the Schloss in Lower Austria, where I made such a fool of myself on my 19th birthday, belonged to a Trieste family of Greek origin. She had written to friends and relations in Budapest. One of them was the former Prime Minister, Count Paul Telecki, and he belonged to a famous, rather romantic Transylvanian family. One recent but fairly distant member exploring Ethiopia had discovered Lake Rudolf and named it after the ill-fated Archduke, and the volcano at its southern tip was called Mount Telecki, but perhaps no longer. Mine, Count Paul, was a famous geographer too. He had mapped the whole Japanese archipelago, and across the table he told us stories of travel among the Terps and Turks and the Arabs when he was helping to draw the frontiers of Mesopotamia. He broke off for lively descriptions of Abdul Hamid and Slatin Pasha, that strange Anglo-Austrian for years the prisoner and running footman of the Mahdi. The Count's alert, pointed face behind horn-rimmed spectacles, lit by a quick, witty and enthusiastic manner, had an almost Chinese look. It's hard to think of anyone kinder. As chief scout of Hungary, he took my travel plans to heart, spread maps, indicated passes and routes, traced rivers, suggested alternative approaches, and enlivened everything as he did so with anecdotes and asides. He'd been foreign minister and later prime minister for a little less than a year, resigning to return to his geographical work when Horthy sent soldiers to stop the return of King Karl. He asked me back a couple of times, and all his family were kind to me in various ways, and when I left, he recommended me to his relations in Transylvania, even gave me a letter to an old Turkish pasha living on the Asiatic shore of the Bosphorus, which suddenly made my journey's end seem something more than an abstraction. Count Teleki became prime minister again at the approach of war in the hopes of rescuing something from the tightening toils of Hungary's horrible predicament. Profoundly pro-British at heart, but forced by the imperatives of the situation into the postures he would least willingly have chosen, he committed suicide in spring 1941 rather than condone Germany's attack on Yugoslavia across Hungarian territory after Hungary had signed a pact of friendship with the Yugoslavs. As Anna Maria, the pretty girl I'd made friends with as a ball, was studying art history, she knew every picture gallery and museum by heart. Thanks to her, I haunted them all. It must have been she who pointed out a remarkable and untypical wrestling match by Courbet, and she acted as open sesame to a private house with a long room which was empty, except for half a dozen tremendous El Grecos. I met a lot of people, and the tempo of life quickened. One exploratory foray into high life led to the drawing room of an ex-reigning beauty equally famous for her looks and her exalted rank. Afterwards, when Berta asked what I thought, I said that she was wonderful looking, but wasn't she a shade precious? Berta laughed. When we were nurses in the war, Ella insisted on working only in the blind wards, saying, I have to, you see, and the others, they all fall in love with me, and I mustn't add to these poor boys' sufferings. Every day, Tibor used to drive out to some military stables beyond Pest to exercise a favourite charger. One morning, he asked me if I'd like to come. He'd got hold of another horse, so we trotted and cantered round the track and went over a few easy jumps. Then we headed for a paddock, where I watched him put his horse through the most arcane and mysterious paces in a silence as rapt and with a skill almost as perfect as those experts in the Spanish riding school in Vienna. I think the outing was a mild vetting, and I must have scraped through, for on the way back he said they might be able to fix up a mount for some of my eastern journey, which would pass the estate of a friend who had plenty of horses. Perhaps she'd lend me one for 2 or 3 days. It's the right way to see the plain. I was so excited by the prospect, I hardly dared to speak. Trivial things, light fuses in the memory. A flower woman on the Danube quay was always calling, Viragot, shipped Viragot, flowers, lovely flowers. The plural of virig, a flower, Viragot, whenever I passed her. 2 years later, reading Ulysses for the first time, I came on the words, Nagyasyakos uram lipoti virag, which is Magyar, more or less, for Leopold Bloom, Esquire. In the book, Bloom was a Jewish immigrant from Hungary. Virag is a typical Magyarization of Bloom, and the spelling must have changed to Bloom when the author resettled his protagonist in Dublin. I feel sure that Joyce, as quick at languages as Borro, must have picked up some Hungarian when he was teaching at the Berlitz School. Pre-war Trieste was still an Austro-Hungarian city with plenty of Hungarians to instruct him. A few of them live there still. He was sometimes thought, but probably wrongly, to have coached Admiral Horthy in English when the future Rollo was last commander of the naval station at Pola. At the same time, I have just discovered he made considerable progress in Demotic Greek. This enthralling port, which I visited for the first time 3 years ago, keeps cropping up in these pages. Literary ghosts abound there. Not only James Joyce and the Burtons, but also Italo Svevo. Perhaps D'Annunzio's phantom biplane zooms inaudibly overhead on the way to Fiume, while the shade of Rilke glides Duino-wards along the Adriatic shore, where they caught a last glimpse of Waring. It was hard to believe I had only been in Budapest 10 days. After a final party, long after midnight, I climbed the steps of Budo with Anna Maria, and we sat on a wall and gazed down at the bridges looped across the Danube in sparkling necklaces. I asked her yet again to repeat a song which had been running in my head ever since the ball. Some Hungarian music is almost as different to a stranger as the language, and nearly as hard. I found the song impossible to get by heart. It tells of a swallow flying low over a field of ripening wheat. She began, "Erika, Erika, Buja Kalash," and went on to the end. But it was no good. The tune escaped yet again, and it is still just out of reach. And that's where I'm going to stop for today. You have been listening to Howard Dillon reading to you from Between the Woods and the Water by Patrick Lee Fermor, a story of his walk across Europe in 1934. Thank you for listening to Tea Time Books, and please stay tuned to KWMR for the rest of this evening's programs. Coming up in just a couple of minutes at 5 o'clock will be a repeat of Epicenter from earlier this week, and that will be followed at 5:50 by As It Happens, and then at 6:24, if my eyes don't deceive me, the National Native News, 6:30, Bakersfield and Beyond with Amanda Eichstadt and Mike Varley, followed by Highway of Heartaches at 8:30? Can't read it. Anyway, later on, till 10 p.m., Highway of Heartaches. At 10 p.m., Stuck in the Psychedelic Era with The Hermit, and then live on KEKP, followed by Professor Cosmo through the night. So that's what you've got coming up on KWMR, to which you are listening. Thanks for listening. See you next time. There's room in there for me. So wear a happy smile and life will be worthwhile. Forget your tears and don't forget to smile. You are my flower that's blooming in the mountain for me. You are my flower that's blooming there for me. When summertime has passed and snow begins to fall, just sing the song and
say to one and